Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So a third night of unrest, not just in Brooklyn Center and Minneapolis, but in cities around the country, including the second city, that would be Chicago. Protesters out in the streets in force in reaction to the Dante Wright police-involved shooting, of course. Some 60 arrests, I think I saw.
Yeah, and yesterday there was 40. So this time they threw fireworks. Still throwing concrete blocks, frozen soda cans, you know, the usuals, at police officers, because that gets stuff done, let me tell you.
And this after a press conference with the Wright family and their legal representation, Benjamin Crump, who seems to be the lawyer in all of these cases, in addition to the news that both Officer Kimberly Potter and Police Chief Tim Gannon had essentially taken the stairs after being given the window. They were fired, or the city council moved to fire them, but they resigned their positions for the good of the community as being the scapegoats. I mean, not so much Potter, obviously, but the Police Chief Gannon being the scapegoat, because he, like the city manager who was shown the door, believes in due process. And the mayor there, Michael Elliott, does not. And that's rather interesting. He's made a couple of interesting statements over the last few days. Again, the mayor of Brooklyn Center is a black gentleman.
Yeah.
Mike Elliott is his name. And in addition to seeming to not be so concerned with due process, which is troublesome, I would say, he also had this to say about reimagining policing in Brooklyn Center, just like the Minneapolis City Council has moved to do in the wake of the George Floyd police-involved killing. Mike Elliott on police stops and whether weapons are needed.
I don't believe that officers need to necessarily have weapons, every time they're making a traffic stop or engaged in situations that don't necessarily call for weapons. We know that there are many other jurisdictions, or even around the world, where that is not, necessarily the case. It's not needed.
What do you think about, the social worker response to a traffic stop, or a unarmed police officer, more of a security guard, responding to making traffic stops and issuing traffic citations, the expired plates, the broken taillights, and that sort of thing? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah. Do you think that would have worked in this case? Well, he tried to flee anyway, even though when there were armed officers. He would have done the same thing if there were unarmed officers. I mean, he did not want to be caught.
He didn't want to be taken in, I suppose, is the point there. That seems to be the problem with talking about traffic stops, nonviolent in nature, traffic citation oriented. So you get citations, nobody's being taken into custody. The problem in this case is, of course, he had an outstanding warrant on a gun charge and a resisting arrest charge. Those are not inconsequential charges. And then he proceeded to resist arrest again, resist being taken in on the outstanding warrant, an outstanding warrant, the result of him failing to show up for his court date. So he's released, he gets a court date, he fails to show up, and there's these charges pending. They're the same people who talk about treating individuals who commit crimes with guns seriously, who obsess about ghost purchases at gun shows and so forth. They don't want to prosecute people who unlawfully carry a firearm, as Dante Wright was alleged to have done.
And the family kept saying, well, it's a misdemeanor charge that they wanted to take him in. But it doesn't matter. He was still charged. And as a parent, if your 20-year-old kid who's got a newborn baby, you know, is got an arrest for has a charge for, you know, weapons possession, don't you think he'd follow up like, hey, did you go to your court hearing? Hey, I mean, I know he's a man. He's over 18, but still.
Well, regardless, whether it's the family or the adult, he's a young adult. He was a young adult. Regardless, the point is that yes, there's accountability there, and then pull back. That's the fact pattern on which we're going to have this conversation again about whether and where police should be armed and so forth. I'm not ideological about this. You try to go where the evidence leads, but it is interesting to note that there has been some research done about how dangerous traffic stops are. I mean, we see how dangerous they are anecdotally, just like we have police-involved shootings that are not representative of what actually goes on 99% of the time between police officers and citizens. And we saw one recently, that terrible incident in New Mexico where that police officer was murdered by some cartel guy who got out of his truck and opened fire on that police officer. If you saw that video, it's terrible. So we see that and we say, well, traffic stops are endemically violent and dangerous for police. Well, let's look at some of the data on this. And this is not an endorsement of what Mayor Elliott offered, but it's context for conversation. And we've talked about this before, this idea that the traffic stop is, you know, perhaps the most dangerous, you know, other than a domestic call, perhaps the most dangerous situation for a police officer. Maybe not. A paper published in the Michigan Law Review in 2019, Policing Danger Narratives and Routine Traffic Stops, found the likelihood of an officer being killed during a routine traffic stop was 1 in 6.5 million. They happen, of course, and it's horrific when they happen, but it's pretty rare. I mean, you're talking about, on the order of a lightning strike. Now, it's not just death we're worried about. We're worried about injury, too. A serious injury to a police officer is estimated to happen in 1 out of every 361,111 stops, and the estimate for the rate of assault against officers, whether it results in injury or not, was only 1 in every 6,959 stops, according to University of Arkansas Professor Jordan Blair Woods, who is the author of the Michigan Law Review report I just referenced. For the study, Woods reviewed data of thousands of traffic stops that resulted in violence against officers across more than 200 law enforcement agencies in Florida over a 10-year period. And from doing that, he developed sort of a typology of violence warning signs. Most commonly, the violence warning signs, signs of flight, Dante Wright, or intoxication. So I raised this study just because it's a little bit more complicated, and we don't want to overextrapolate from the anecdotal any more than we overextrapolate from the anecdotal or the press corps does, you know, the moral panic sets in. We overextrapolate from the anecdotal when it comes to police-involved shootings. It turns out that most police civilian encounters, both directions, come off without an incident. And it's the times when there is an incident, it is usually the civilian who is instigating the incident, escalating. And on a rare occasion, it's the police officer who's in the wrong, as we've seen before. We've talked about these individual cases. But if you don't go sort of through that nuanced thought process and consider these events in the scope of the interactions between, you know, 750,000 police officers spread across 330 million people, then you make all kinds of terrible public policy choices, including giving the streets over to criminals, which is perhaps the worst public policy choice you can make, and it's the public policy of choice for the left. Rich Lowry has a good piece in New York Post about this, this idea that we expect rioting and violence to occur in the wake of any police-involved shooting, regardless of the particulars of that police-involved shooting. New study released on the Social Science Research Network examined cities with Black Lives Matter protests 2014 to 2019 and found that lethal use of force by cops declined enough to account for roughly 300 fewer deaths. On the other hand, the study found a 10% increase in homicides, resulting in 1,000 to 6,000 more deaths over that period. So Lowry asks, is there anyone who's comfortable with this blood-soaked trade, which reduces police killings at the cost of, at the very least, hundreds and perhaps thousands of additional murders of mainly young Black men? This is not a peer-reviewed study yet. It will be, but its findings are, you know, consistent with the Ferguson effect studies that we've talked about with people like Heather McDonald. We're just making terrible trade-offs, and we're making ill-informed public policy because we're making public policy in response to moral panicking rather than in response to sort of sober consideration and measure in terms of what are some of the issues, what do we understand about the dynamic generally, and how do we make policy consistent with what we understand to be the most likely scenario while providing for consequences for the unlikely scenarios when they occur. That's just a conversation you have almost nowhere in America. I mean, other than on Morning Answer, of course.
312-642-5600, turnkey dot pro answer line.
Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. My understanding is that the city manager was let go because he called for due process in this case. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so the police chief.
Due process, and they're let go.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's my suggestion to all of those that want to basically allow or move towards a police going to traffic stops unarmed or just as civilians or as social workers. I would like to see those that propose those ideas become the test bed for those. I want to see the mayor go out and do this and see how it works. I want to see representatives that call for a police and society do this. Dan and Amy, I believe in everything you say, and I believe in truth, and I believe in science, and I believe in numbers. I believe in all of it. But we are now in an environment that does not believe in any of that because it doesn't need an agenda. And the agenda is to tear down our country and Western civilization. Due process is no longer important to people. We knew that long ago.
Well, it's also
but
everyone's feelings. You don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. All this is
well, you know what? You know what? You're going to hurt people's feelings because there will be collateral damage, seen and unseen, for generations. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Greg. Jim in Crown Point.
You know, these people that are killed by the police, this is the reason you have the police. These are the people that are the square peg trying to get into the round hole. They operate outside the law. There's laws. And I look at it as thinning the herd. And I'll tell you something. I hung out with a kid when I was 17. This kid was tough. He didn't back down from anybody, didn't listen to anybody. One day he was driving down the street fast, and a guy on his porch threw a beer can at him. He left. My friend left to get his buddies. And this guy's neighbor said, you better get your gun because they're coming back. So my friend came back, and the guy shot him in the head. This kid should have never come back. This is the consequences of people that think that they don't have to operate outside, that they operate outside the law. And all this garbage, this is my truth. No, there's laws. That's the truth.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The FDA's decision to pause the J&J vaccination will kill people.
Yeah.
Ronald Bailey writing in Reason Magazine. Bailey has been good for a long time in a number of issues, writes in the science space, particularly on the junk science around climate change hysteria. He writes simply, the risks of blood clots are much lower than the risks of COVID-19 illness and hospitalizations. In 2020, a meta-analysis of The Lancet found that more than one in five very ill hospitalized and postmortem COVID-19 patients experience venous thromboembolism, blood clots of the veins.
Yeah. Cerebral venous sinus thrombosis.
He also notes that, you know, six cases, as we talked about yesterday, out of 6.8 million people who have been inoculated, all women between aged 18 to 48, the odds amount to one in 1.13 million, which is comparable to your annual chances of being struck by lightning. Here we go again with struck by lightning. And so,
it's an anomaly.
Yeah, the point here is out of an abundance of caution, we're doing a silly thing again, like we did with respect to locking down the country over COVID cases.
I mean, this is stupid. So one woman died. They're not telling us her age, but here's a 29-year-old woman. She's hospitalized with a blood clot. She lives in Nashville.
I went to the ER a week after the shot when I was having fever, and they didn't find anything strange in my blood work. So went home, and just continued to kind of worsen over the following week. When I went back to the ER, it was because my leg was so swollen that I couldn't really walk. So at that time, they found, the DVTs or the clots in my legs.
And this is only happening in women. And what else causes blood clots is being on birth control pills. And they tell you that, too, when you go on them, even, you know, whatever age you are, there's a chance of getting blood clots if you take birth control pills. So they're trying to figure out, you know, these women's medical history. Because in life, even before there was a J&J vaccine, 5 in 1 million people get this cerebral sinus thrombosis. So I think we're jumping the gun here and just, you know, pulling back all those vaccines. I don't think it's worth it. And guess who got a J&J vaccine? Governor Pritzker, he got one.
Uh-huh.
He's 3 weeks out so far. What do you think? He's doing okay. It's, you know, nothing
he's
major.
It's just like one big walking clot. So does this impact your view of the vaccine, getting vaccinated, the J&J vaccination, if and when that comes back online? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You know, I understand that there's the dismissal of concerns about the vaccinations has given people pause, and that's fair. Anytime somebody shuts you up and says, well, you can't ask a question, you can't raise an issue. If there weren't interest in raising questions and addressing issues, then why would the CDC set up the VAERS system to report adverse outcomes with vaccinations across the board? Yeah, that's exactly why there's a system for that. Now, it's not covered, but that's why they set it up. So this is part of scientific understanding as well. So I understand why that causes a pause, and then it creates cynicism about the vaccinations and those that are the most fervent cheerleaders for the vaccines. However, you also don't want to get into the business, as I was sort of indicating, of taking anomalous cases and saying, well, this is what's happening. This is center cut, because it just clearly isn't. And so, you know, this is not a push to get vaccinated per se, but it is a push to be balanced in our understanding of the risks associated with vaccinations, just as we tried to be balanced in our understanding of the risks associated with spread and infection and so forth.
Right, but this is too. This is why it should be a decision between you and your doctor, and you shouldn't be forced to get a vaccine, which, you know, the unions, the CTU, now wants all of us parents, CPS parents, and our kids to get vaccinated. No, that this is, you know, this pause in the J&J vaccine really brought that to light. Like, this is not their decision. This is not my employer's decision. This is a decision between me and my doctor on whether or not I should get vaccinated. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, I think more and more, and this, of course, in the context of the vaccine passport debate, but more and more, it's going to be a decision that involves your employer, too. I mean, what did we see yesterday? The NFL issuing a memo to restrict unvaccinated coaches and staff from working with players. You got to basically, you got to get vaccinated in order to work in the NFL. So, is that coming to your employer? Likely. Because what? Out of an abundance of caution for their bottom line, they want people back to work and they want that work service uninterrupted. So why take a chance from their perspective? Randy in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. This is part of that fear-mongering that goes on. To your point, the percentages of people that are getting the clots or having issues with it is so minuscule in the grand scheme of things, but there's always that part of society and particular politics that want us to be afraid, because if we're afraid, they control us more, and that's where we are. It's no worse than the COVID. If you get COVID, 90% or 80% or not, or more, 97% recover with no issues whatsoever. Yet we fear-monger about that 3%. It's just a crime. Crime isn't rampant among certain communities, but they magnify it because it fits the narrative. It fits the fear-mongering of this country, of the political class in this country. You'll never convince me otherwise, and a lot of society feel the same way. That's why we turn the news off. That's why we get sick of it.
Thanks for the call, Randy. Yeah, as we'll hear later from a CNN technical producer, not on this topic, but in general, fear sells.
Yeah.
and never forget that the D.C. press corps outlets are businesses with bottom lines, too. Mm-hmm. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hi, good morning. You know, we used to talk about and joke about people just being too sensitive to live, you know, because people, it's all about your feelings and how do you feel. Well, if you're that sensitive, then you don't belong out here in this world, you know, stay in. And now there's too much risk. There's too much risk in these vaccines. And like you said, Amy, it's overreported. If you look at it with context, birth control pills do cause blood clots.
Oh, yeah. Now, oh, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so big deal. Is everyone going to go off their birth control? Why don't you report that all over the news, that birth control pills cause blood clots, and see what people do? It doesn't make sense. It's always out of context. What, Dan?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Yeah. And what you're saying in terms of how people would react if you reported on
the
number of cases or the percentage, the incidence of blood clots that are associated with taking birth control. But, of course, they never report that because there's no interest in that discussion.
No, but your doctor always tells women that, like, if you take this, there is a 10% chance you can get a blood clot.
Right. So everyone go off your birth control. Makes no sense, but, you know,
it's a risk many women are willing to take. I mean,
exactly. So give me that Johnson & Johnson vaccine and put it back on the market. What the hell's wrong with you people?
Well, think about United Center. Thanks, starting tomorrow, United Center was all going to be J&J shots. And now Governor Pritzker is scrambling and he's getting 50,000 shots of Pfizer Moderna to those locations. I have a friend that's flying in from the Netherlands to get a J&J shot. She already bought her ticket. She's coming in next week. I lined up her, you know, I'm a vaccination handler. And I called them yesterday and they said, we don't know. So then we got to find a different location.
Why are you bringing the Dutch in here to get our vaccines?
Well, they make J&J in Holland, but you can't get a vaccine in Europe. It is almost impossible. In fact, my friends in Europe don't even know anybody who's had the vaccine.
Is there going to be some sort of exchange? Do we get windmills or wooden shoes in exchange for the vaccine?
What do you want? I'll ever bring over something for you. But, I mean, it's crazy. Now, you know, people are going to Gary, Indiana, at the baseball field there. They've got hundreds of open slots for people to get vaccinated with the Pfizer and Moderna.
Well, this is a story about, you know, the regulatory, the fourth arm of government, too, sort of the administrative bureaucracy, these regulatory agencies. And Tyler Cohen, George Mason University econ professor, had good response to the FDA's response to its critics in proposing this pause. He writes, the FDA says their credibility is on the line. If they allow the vaccine use to proceed and a modest number of people die as a result, even with a big increase in net lives saved, the FDA and its defenders claim that people will lose faith in the FDA. Yet this is exactly the wrong thing to say. It's self-serving. It exacerbates the problem at hand. When the FDA announces that they have to ban a vaccine because it's credibility on the line, that very announcement puts their credibility on the line. It's a simple two-line proof. Either they're lying about whether their credibility is on the line, in which case they have wrecked their credibility with a lie, or they're telling the truth, in which case, by definition, the credibility is indeed on the line. You shouldn't always be running around trying to extend your credibility and using that as the basis to make decisions that are other regarding, is his point, and I think it's a good one. Chris and Carrie are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, I don't know if you saw this, but I think it was WGN yesterday came out with a story that Barrington School District is already making plans for remote learning for next year. At least it's in the works to at least be prepared. So I think you called it, what, last September. You said, I guarantee that CPS will not start on time or start remote in the next fall. So if a suburban school district is doing this, you can only imagine what the CPS is doing. They don't want to go back.
No, and we're fighting for 12 days in total, but we'll talk about CPS later. But it's, they're not going back to this. But even St. Ignatius, my friends whose kids go there, they're planning for remote learning for next fall already.
Thanks for the call,
so,
Chris.
But what if, even if you get vaccinated, our kids can't go back to school? Isn't that the part? Isn't that the carrot dangling in front of us? You know, get vaccinated, then things can go back to normal.
Yeah, now it's extended family. Then it'll be not until the developing world has been vaccinated out of a sense of equity. I mean, it's just...
Yes, it'll go on. That's a good one, Dan. Yeah.
The lockdowners like their lockdowns. Speaking of which, Mick Jagger.
Oh, yeah.
He's with a little band called the Rolling Stones, you may have heard of. The kids seem to like this. And by kids, I mean people in their 70s. Uh-huh. He's got a new song out called Easy Sleazy that's about COVID, and it's intended to give a bit of optimism about coming out of these lockdowner policies, of which he clearly is not a fan. And it's actually not bad, especially for an octogenarian. He's like Bernie Sanders' age, isn't he?
Yeah.
Do you Dave
have it?
Grohl,
can we hear it?
He's got Dave Grohl with him from Foo Fighters on bass and drums, too. It's pretty good.
Took it on the chin. The numbers were so grim. Buster and my bricks. Stiffen up our lips. Yeah. Pacing in the yard. You're trying to take the making mistakes. I'm really dead. Looking at the drops through the magnifying glass. Pencil all the tools. Footballs make applause. Yeah. No more travel brochures. Virtual premieres. I've got nothing left to wear. Looking out.
Yeah, it's not bad. Easy sleazy, bossed around by pricks. I like that.
Little Justin here, our technical producer, said this is a little loud. Does he sound old? It's a little loud for me.
Okay. He's more like a Kenny G, Michael Bolton. He's likes a good balladeer.
Yeah. To be fair, I did like the stand and deliver, the Clapton one.
Oh, yeah, that was good, too, with Van Morrison, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I forgot about that. That's a good one, too. It's nice that we're getting a whole new genre of music that's COVID-related. he does actually, though, in this song, he does go after those who are anti-vax, lyrics go like this. Shooting the vaccine, Bill Gates is in my bloodstream. It's mind control. The earth is flat and cold. It's never warming up. The Arctic's turned to slush. The second coming's late. There's aliens in the deep state. So he's essentially, you know, comparing anti-vaxxers to flat earthers, conspiracy theorists. But overall, he's pretty good, and he's pretty pro, you know, opening up. So.
Yeah. Good. Good for him.
You know, that's what can you expect from the rock and roll industry? That's pretty good. Jim in Wooddale.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So this vaccine is technically not a vaccine. It's an experimental vaccine. It's not been peer-reviewed for many years. It's not been tested on animals. Dr. Simone Gold at AmericasFrontlineDoctors.com and Dr. Tenpenny lay it out perfectly. Also, Dr. Tenpenny in her video states that there is going to be severe autoimmune disease, which Tucker Carlson briefly mentioned last night, anywhere between 3 to 6 months and 20 years down the road. And it's starting to happen. So people really need to research what they're doing and what they're putting in their body.
And thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, the J&J vaccine is more of the traditional platform versus the mRNA vaccines, right? Pfizer and Moderna. Mm-hmm. But we'll continue this conversation actually a little bit later in the show. We'll have a pathologist on to discuss this in more detail. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
They got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Yeah, that's more Justin genre of music there. Sort of go-go's, you know, a little bit more fun-loving. Dave Grohl is too hard edge for Justin. campus reform is on the job. Campus reform is a project of the Leadership Institute. Send an able reporter to the campus of Georgetown.
Oh, you don't say.
Georgetown. Now, these are some of our best and brightest, remember.
Oh, that's right. They're better than our graduates from Iowa.
Well.
Hey, easy there on the Hawkeyes.
I mean, yeah. Let's.
Okay. Right, well. All right.
So the question or the topic was the Georgia election reform law.
Oh, that racist hack piece of legislation?
Right. Jim Crow on steroids. Correct. Yes. And what the reporter did was not identify the Georgia voting reform law. He just read the provisions of the law to the students and then asked questions about it. So here's how that went.
There's some legislation going around and a lot of people are talking about it. Some of the things it would do to expand voting is it would require weekend early voting for 2 Saturdays. It was previously just 1, so now it would be 2. Also give counties the option to expand it to 2 Sundays as well. It would clarify the polling hours more, make it more evident when voting is, when you can go cast your vote, and it would ban electioneering within 150 feet of the polls. It would require voter identification for in-person and absentees so that you can't cast multiple ballots, you can't vote illegally. Would you support legislation like that?
Yeah, I mean, making sure that people aren't casting more than one vote, and that sounds kind of common sense to me. So
yeah, I think that allowing voters more time to vote is never a bad thing. I think that making sure that they can verify their identity is also not a bad thing, so that there's no like illegal voting happening or anything like that.
Definitely the first two.
Yeah.
Why not the last one?
Not everyone has access to an ID or has the ability to get one. Not everybody has a static location where they live.
Yeah, definitely the first two, and having it available more. Open on weekends especially because a lot of people just work during the week.
The ability to vote on the weekend specifically makes a lot of sense.
Well, given that these kids, Georgetown undergrads, support the provisions of the law, of what was proposed there, would they support taking those provisions and replacing the Georgia election law with those provisions, which of course are the provisions of the Georgia election law?
Do you think that this would be a good substitute for the Georgia bill? Obviously, Joe Biden called it the Jim Crow on steroids, so.
Yeah, yeah, anything's better than that.
You'd support this over that.
For sure.
I think, I
think so.
Yeah, I think that anything that suppresses voters isn't helpful. If you're truly trying to, like, reform voting, you should try and make it so it's more accessible.
I think the former is what you... what I would agree with, yes.
Like, everything you said makes sense in terms of a proposition for voting. My understanding was that Biden was misrepresenting it a little bit and calling it Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm. Does it sound like Jim Crow on steroids?
What if I told you that this actually was the Georgia voting bill? Would that shock you?
As far as, like, I was knowledgeable about it, yeah, it would shock me, yes.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, it does open it more, but it's still, there's less locations.
What have you heard about the Georgia bill?
It did ban allowing people to, like, give water to voters.
Election officials are actually, they're allowed to give out water. You can go outside of the 150-foot zone of the voting area and grab water and stuff. It just bans electioneering from 150 within 150 feet. Do you think that the media and politicians are kind of fanning some flames to try to stoke division? Do you think that when people actually read the bill, they'll see it's actually not that bad?
Probably. I think that I didn't read up on the Georgia bill before, and so I mean,
I don't know if anyone's deliberately like flaring this up.
Does this legislation I just read off to you sound like Jim Crow on steroids?
No, I guess not.
No, I guess not. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636DA, turnkey.protextline. Those are Georgetown University students. They're going to be at big law firms and corporate C-suites and institutions of higher learning, in quotation marks, higher learning. They're going to be part of the elite class, the ruling class, for the most part, aren't they? With that credential in these times, in this country? Sure. And so it's such a great illustration of the power of the media and the power of the branding that all of these allied leftist organizations are engaged in. They know this. You can have all the credentials in the world, but few will resist succumbing to the relentless barrage of propaganda that the left is able to put out because with the, you know, the biggest blowtorches in the world. And that's exactly what they have. And I think that that was so useful in the context of this Project Veritas undercover effort, Project Veritas on the job again. They got a CNN technical producer named Charlie Chester to go on the record again, guerrilla reporting, undercover reporting, and admit things that we know to be true, but it's nice to hear somebody from inside the castle saying them to confirm what we know to be true, isn't it? So think about this, and think about what Charlie Chester says in the context of, you know, it's voter suppression, it's Jim Crow on steroids, it's this and that, just using this as the example, and how easily buffaloed the passively engaged Georgetown student was, not to mention, you know, the great hoi polloi out in the hustings in America. Charlie Chester on CNN's role in ousting Trump.
I think we got him through this term. We would always hear shots of him jogging, him in aviator shades, and like you paint him as a young geriatric.
We were creating a story there that we didn't know anything about. You know, we were, so that's I think that's propaganda.
Look what we did. We got Trump back. I am 100% going to say it. And I 100% believe it, that if it wasn't for CNN, I don't know that Trump would have gotten voted out.
Our focus was to get Trump out of office, right? Without saying it, that's what it was, right? So our next thing is going to be for climate change awareness.
Do you think it's going to be just like a lot of like fear, like climate?
Yeah, fear sells. Fear sells.
No one ever says those things out loud, but it's obvious.
Fear sells, so climate change is on deck, yep. Right? But in the interim, they have Matt Gaetz to go after.
Yeah.
And this is not taking a position on the Gaetz matter because, I don't know, it's tough to make heads or tails of it. There are definitely some concerning factoids that have come out about Venmo payments and the like. But, of course, I'm not going to solely take the characterization of the evidence and the fact that it is mainly from somebody who's facing a, you know, 36 federal charges as the sole source on this. So this is not a position on Gates. This is a position on the reporting on Gates. And listen to what Charlie Chester has to say about that.
You guys seeing the news propaganda?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay, can you define propaganda for me? Like, I think I know, but, like, how is it, what's the mechanism?
If the agenda, say, is to, like, get, like, Matt Gaetz right now, he's, like, he's Republican, like, he's a problem for the Democratic Party because he's so conservative, right? And he can cause a lot of hiccups in passing of laws. So it would be great for the Democratic Party to get him out. So we're going to keep running those stories to keep hurting him and make it so that he can't be buried and, like, just, you know, settled outside of court and just, like, you know, if we keep pushing that, it's helping us. That's propaganda. It's helping us in some way.
That's propaganda because it's helping us. We're just going to keep pushing those stories on Gates because he's a target. We want to get rid of him.
Yeah, he's a good-looking conservative.
So when she was asked, when she asked him, you know, give me a definition of propaganda, he used their coverage of the Matt Gaetz matter as an example, as well as he did their coverage of Biden, you know, aviator glasses. He's sort of a young, hip geriatric.
Right.
And they're obviously their stated public effort to get rid of Trump.
Well, they choose a video that they want to use. I mean, they could make Biden look real bad if they showed other shots, but they want him active, like young, jogging, looking hip and cool. So that's what they did.
And again, with respect to Gaetz, this is not just some guy, oh, he's just, you know, talking trash over drinks and not realizing, but it's just a bunch of big talk. No, it's big talk that reflects how CNN actually operates. Raheem Kassem over at National Pulse caught one of them. A reporter named Gabby Orr at CNN, former Politico reporter, she wanted to report that Gaetz had been denied a meeting with former President Trump, you know, again, to give the idea that he is being isolated and he's been ostracized. She sent an email. I wanted to run something by you for confirmation before reporting out. I was told by two people familiar with Congressman Gaetz that he asked to meet with former President Trump at Mar-a-Lago last week and was denied. But she did report it out. She reported that as a story before receiving any confirmation from either side. The original CNN story claimed neither side had responded, which wasn't true. The Gaetz office did respond, saying he was welcome to Trump Doral this week, had not sought to meet with President Trump himself. So she went with something that she heard. She didn't wait for confirmation or denial from either side, and she reported it as fact. This is similar to the whole story about Gaetz seeking a pardon from President Trump before
that was simply not true.
He left office, which Trump denied.
Right.
Well, they both denied. But again, so Gaetz is in the cross. Again, this is not in the merits of the case. Just focus on the coverage of it for a second. He's the target. And so start cranking the propaganda machine. Trump's the target. So start cranking the propaganda machine. Georgia voting law is the target. So start cranking the propaganda machine. We are these are political. I mean, I know this is obvious to so many of our listeners, but you have to provide the evidentiary basis. You can't just make claims. You need to support them. And that's what we're doing here. And that's what you should do, too. These are great examples. These are political activists. This is nothing more. They're nothing better than comms directors or ad makers for a politician or for a political party. That's what they are.
Oh, I know. And if, you know, I used to watch CNN because I'd talk about it on the show, too. And now I only have to, or I do it for work if need be. But a month before the election, Dan, the morning show, they were crazed about ripping on Trump. And they were physically involved. You know, instead of reporting the story, they were, you know, jumping in the chair. Like, you know, we've got to be sure to vote. And look what Trump did now. And they were angry. And it was their whole physique changed. It was so crazy, and I cannot turn that show on again.
But separate pundits, you know, the Morning Joes and the Mad Owls and the Chris A's. I can never tell those two apart. Same person, I think. Hannity, talk pundits, they have opinions. It's obviously that's an opinion show and so forth. There is no straight news reporting. There is none.
Well, maybe Brett Barron's special report.
Virtually. But even that's an opinion show. He's moderating an opinion show. Yes, they're doing news stories and stuff, too. And he tells the news straight before he goes to the roundtable discussion to, you know, dissect it. But, I mean, these outlets do not do news reporting. I'm not saying that the punditry bleeds into it, that opinion bleeds into it, that there's some reporters that are, I'm saying that as an organization, their mission, their daily operation is not as a news organization. It is that it's a political comms shop. That's what they do. This is not a bug. It's a feature. Joe and Franklin Parker in Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, there you go again, Dan, letting facts get in the way of a story. How dare you do that?
Right.
You know, that's what these reporters have to do is push back. You know, why wouldn't Jen Psaki ask, a simple question. Did Biden read the Georgia election bill? Okay. What specific section of the bill is Jim Crow on steroids? Where is that question? I work in a field where we do a lot of audits for Department of Justice and that for Medicare fraud. And I always take people to task. Show me the source document. Show me where it states that in the law. The misinformation is breathtaking out there.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Joe. I mean, right. Our friends, the Edgar County Watchdogs, who says and what evidence do you got? Two questions. You make a claim? All right. Who says and what evidence? Show me. Prove it up. Walk me through the logic of a position. No problem. I wish campus reform could get access to Fortune 500 CEOs, but of course they can't, because I will guarantee you that the CEO of Delta Airlines or the CEO of Merck would do no better in answering those questions that campus reform reporter put to Georgetown students than the Georgetown students did.
Yep.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and in the interest of being as even-handed as we can, reflective of the truth on the ground, profile people who are standing up as well as people who are the bad examples, including in the teaching profession. But lest anyone try to smear what we do on this program as being anti-teacher, anti-public schools, or anti-this, or anti... No. Now, we make decisions based on the institutional work product and individual conduct. It's revolutionary, I know.
Oh, and Dan, I just wanted to tell you this, too. CPS parents did have a reopen high school rally yesterday, and guess how many people showed up?
Probably fewer than showed up for those White Lives Matter rallies over the weekend.
Baker's dozen, yeah.
No, dozen. So, well, one for each day of education you're going to get this year.
Exactly.
Hopefully we can just come to a sensible agreement and get the kids back to school
now
so that we don't have to revisit this all in August.
He doesn't think. Excuse me. He doesn't think we're going to revisit this in August? Is he nuts? Like, where are these people living? Of course we're going to revisit that. They're going to want hazard pay, and we're not going back to school next year.
It seems to be working.
Yeah, it's working out really well, huh?
And in point of fact, not educating kids has been something CPS has been involved with for at least the last half century. So why stop? People seem to like this.
And people, don't forget, they killed grandma because they took shot. They jumped the line and went ahead of people who have comorbidities and who are elderly. And they're still not back in school. So shame on them. Worried about killing grandma? They're the ones who killed grandma.
Well, let's move from an institution that is a punchline, and that would be the Chicago Public School System, unfortunately. Not for the kids in it, but the work product is, and so many of the, at least the rank and file CTU apparatchiks that masquerade as educators. Here's a real educator. His name's Paul Rossi. He's a math teacher at Grace Church High School in Manhattan. Grace Church High School in Manhattan. The annual tuition there is $46,000.
Ooh, that's like Latin. Okay.
He had changed careers about a decade ago when he discovered, as he described, how rewarding it is to help young people explore the truth and beauty of mathematics. That was 10 years ago. That was way back. You may remember it. Our listeners may remember this. 10 years ago was when 2 plus 2 still equaled 4, and it was not a debate.
And you didn't have to explain why it was that way?
The title of his piece is, "I Refuse to Stand By While My Students Are Indoctrinated. Children are afraid to challenge the repressive ideology that rules our school. That's why I am." This is probably a piece many teachers could write at many of these elite K through 12 schools around the country. And what is he talking about? I hope you can fill in the blank at this stage. The anti-racist indoctrination training. Anti-racist, euphemism for racist. In order to maintain, he writes that the training requires him, of course it does, to treat his students differently based on race. Oh. And I know that's something that we've, again, talked about here at length, but I think that's just an elegant way to say it in very simple terms. You are forcing me to treat my students differently based on their race. If you put that question to people on the street, should people be treated differently, students in a classroom, be treated differently based on their race? How many people would say, yes, they should? Very few people would, because what do you immediately think? Well, somebody is being discriminated against, or somebody is being treated worse than somebody else based on their race. That seems to go against trying to get to, you know, equal justice before the law, equal protection under the law, equal opportunity for kids in school. Seems to run against all these ideas of fairness that we have. But that's the ideology that is everywhere in K through 12 and collegiate systems and corporate boardrooms. Forcing me to treat my students different based on their race. Just think about that and also share that. That is a one-sentence description of what's going on. Beautiful. He raised questions about the ideology being inculcated at a mandatory, of course, wait for it, whites-only student and faculty Zoom meeting.
There you go.
Segregated sessions. Treat my students differently. Let's select out by race.
Well, I got to tell you, these coaching clinics I have to go to, they, you know, tell us to get a group that represents your community.
What does that mean?
They said, it's got to be diverse.
How many?
What?
How many from each
category? From each category? Because I have more Hispanics than I do white people. Is this bad? And what am I going to put her on the team because of her ethnicity?
He raised questions in this Zoom meeting, whites only, for students and faculty, about the ideology. He writes, "It seemed like my questions broke the ice. Students and even a few teachers offered a broad range of questions and observations. Many students said it was more productive and substantive discussion than they expected." Yeah, hard to be less. But when my questions were shared outside the forum, violating the school norm of confidentiality, "We have a nail sticking up. Somebody get a hammer.
Hurry."
I was informed by the head of the high school that my philosophical challenges had caused harm to students. Given that these topics were life and death matters about people's flesh and blood and bone, I was reprimanded for acting like an independent agent of a set of principles or ideas or beliefs, and I was told that by doing so, I failed to serve the greater good and the higher truth. He was further informed, Paul Rossi, this math teacher, he created a dissonance for vulnerable and uninformed thinkers, and neurological disturbance in students' beings and systems. Oh, man. I asked a question. I did all that. Wow. The school's director of studies said that my remarks could even constitute harassment.
Oh.
I ask questions about this ideology, questions that students have, raised issues that they share, harassment. Now, listen to this, the reprimand. It's not a private reprimand, well, not exclusively. A few days later, the head of school ordered all high school advisors to read a public reprimand of my conduct out loud to every student in the school. It was a surreal experience walking the halls alone and hearing the words emitting from each classroom. Events from last week compel us to underscore some aspects of our mission and share some thoughts about our community. At independent schools, with our history of predominantly white populations, racism colludes with other forms of bias to undermine our stated ideals, and we must work hard to undo this history, so on and so forth. And Paul Rossi is banished. Paul Rossi, you shall do the walk of atonement through the halls of Grace Church School. This is how it's being treated. So on the one hand, you say, well, this is why people don't step up. And on the other hand, I say, this is exactly why people need to step up.
Uh-huh.
If Paul Rossi can do it, why can't you? And I'm including teachers. I'm specifically, actually, talking to teachers.
And the teachers that we know that want to be back in school, go back in school, at least teach from school. That's a start. Teach from your classroom. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
He asked questions like, what does speaking up mean in a context in which white students are asked to interrogate their white saviorism, quote unquote, but also not make their anti-racist practice about them? Well, exactly. This is, you know, you're an oppressor and it's your job to look out for minorities. Wait, what? What? I mean, this is the same conversation we had about the school in California and the teacher there yesterday. Yeah. He, you know, you have low income students that are on there on scholarship. Instead of telling everybody at Grace at this school in Manhattan, you know, you're at an elite school. You are very fortunate. Take advantage of it. I don't care if you're high income, low income, white, black, whatever. You are in a great position to get the kind of education that most parents would crawl through broken glass to get. At least it used to be offered here. Obviously, now it's been taken over by identitarian ideologues. But nonetheless, the credential alone will open doors that are going to be open for very few people in this country, in this world. And instead, they're all navel-gazing with this identitarian gibberish. Isn't it remarable? He goes on. He's got all sorts of, you know, re-education that he has to go through as part of his continuing employment at the school and so on and so forth. But this sort of what's most important. One current student paid me a visit a few weeks ago. He tapped faintly on my office door, anxiously looking both ways before entering. He said he had come to offer me words of support for speaking up at that meeting, the Zoom call I referenced. I thanked him for his comments but asked him why he seemed so nervous. He told me he was worried that a particular teacher might notice this visit and it would mean that I would get in trouble. You went to see Paul Rossi? He reported to me that this teacher once gave him a lengthy talking to for voicing a conservative opinion in class. He then remembered with a sigh of relief that this teacher was absent that day. I looked him in the eyes. I told him he was a brave young man for coming to see me and that he should be proud of that. Then I sent him on his way, and I resolved to write this piece. So not just standing up for yourselves or for your kids, all this prattling on endlessly about bullying and this and that. So who's going to stand up for that kid that went to see Paul Rossi and just say, you know, I appreciate what you did, but I'm afraid? Are you going to stand up for your kid who's afraid? Are you a teacher who's going to stand up for kids like that who are afraid to offer a legitimate questions, who are who have viewpoints that are that you should be helping to develop, not instill command control style, but to develop, who are looking to talk to people, understand, or you're just going to be a thug or a coward, which is the two terms are synonymous, of course. I hope this piece gets wide distribution, and I hope Paul Rossi either is able to get some scales fall from eyes at his school in Manhattan, or he finds a school that appreciates his talents, because obviously he has a lot to give as a math teacher and as a
as
thought
a
leader.
Seasoned, right, as a citizen of this
leader.
Country.
Verlon on the South Side.
This is what happens when you engage the left. It's a disingenuous conversation because they put you in a position to engage from a point of weakness because they're going to tell you you benefit from white privilege and white fragility. And you're always going to be on defense. So what can you do? You see, this person has been guilt-shamed. He's been shamed, not even guilt-shamed, but the average white person is guilt-shamed. And so they already make the regular English language into you can't say certain words. Certain words are bad words now. If you call somebody lazy and he's black.
I know all that.
You know?
I know all that. And then I would just go back to that elegant statement that he made. My school is forcing me to treat kids in my class differently based on their race. Do you support that? That's
no.
No, I know you don't. I'm saying that's the question that should be put back to every identitarian goon that you come across. Tell me that you support that. Who wants to publicly say that's what they're doing? That's what they're doing. So admit it. Celebrate it. Tell us that's the game. Tell us that's your agenda. Answer the question.
Well, you know what I should do, what you should tell people, and this is what I'm going to tell people right now. Grow up here and tell these people to screw off. That's what you tell people.
Thanks for the call, Verlon. Joe and Tinley.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that to my family. Look what they did to all Trump's guys, Flynn. They would destroy my grandkids, my children. They would lose their jobs if I ran against them. I'm not afraid, but, you know, I wouldn't want my father to do that to me when I was 25 years old.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you're our only hope, bro.
Well, I don't know about that joke. Thanks for the call.
It's a great responsibility, dude.
Yeah, right.
You ready for it?
It's not a one-person job. No. And everybody has a role to play, and not everybody can be Paul Rossi, and not everybody has the platform that we have. I get that. Not everybody has the. I've said this before on this very topic. Not everybody has an employer who shares the country's founding principles. I understand. But you also have to understand this axiomatic statement. They will come for you in some form or fashion, and they will come for your family too, because there is no... Yeah. There is no space they will not occupy if you appease and defer. So you better decide where you are willing to make a stand. Dawn in Plainfield.
Hi, good morning. I agree that there is a real problem. You know, if somebody says that there isn't a problem, you can point them to the school's own report card. Look at the gap between African Americans. Look at the gap with children with disabilities in reading and writing and math. So there is a real problem, but the schools ignore it and they defend it. And that's the real problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Dawn. Appreciate it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The other week, we played a clip from this video that was posted making the rounds. A pathologist in Idaho named Dr. Ryan Cole gave a little sort of community briefing on COVID, and he had some things to say about deaths and masks and risk factors that few medical professionals are willing to say, despite the evidence that supports the statements you'll hear.
Average COVID-19 death age, 78.6. Average age of death in North America every year, 78.6. That's fascinating. What are our highest risk factors? Obesity, low vitamin D levels, advanced age. 90% of deaths in the state have been over 70 years of age. That's the at-risk population. We have stopped our society for something that's taking people that are already at that death risk age anyway. The virus is fragile. These are just little tidbits. It's fragile. It doesn't live outside. UV light fractionates it, kills it, blows it apart. Ventilation in the wind blows it away. It is insanity to wear a mask outside. It is absolute insanity. And that's science. That's science. There is not one study that has shown any super spreader event to have occurred outside. They have all been indoors with poor ventilation.
Dr. Ryan Cole, pathologist, owns and operates Cole Diagnostics, a testing lab in Garden City, Idaho. And maybe we'll also get a little bit of a distillation on the difference between the Idaho potato and the russet. I'm always interested in discussing potatoes. Dr. Ryan Cole, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Dan.
Reaction that you got, some in the medical community I saw online after your talk went viral, were quite critical of some of the things you had to say, not so much on what we heard there from that clip, although, of course, you do have some mask enthusiasts that were critical, but more specifically on the vaccines and the suggestion that there should be a healthy level of skepticism around these vaccines.
Certainly. And so as far as the vaccines go, I mean, obviously we saw yesterday the pullback of the J&J shot right now. And I think that speaks to the fact that these are experimental in the sense that even in the authorization that the federal government has given to them, the word investigational vaccines sits on the front of those. And these are not licensed. They're not approved. They're emergency authorized and still under investigation and being used, obviously, as an emergency measure. And again, I've had my childhood vaccines and travel vaccines. So of my kids, I haven't had these shots because, obviously, I'm waiting on the science. And I know that there's a long history with coronavirus vaccines in this family of vaccines where they seem to work up front, especially in the animal models. But down the road, they go very badly when the experimental subjects were exposed to a wild-type variant of the virus. And that's my concern. It's, you know, I think there are a lot of very safe vaccines for a lot of diseases that saved a lot of humanity over decades. But that's my hesitancy. And not even a hesitancy. I don't like when the media uses that word because I think it biases those of us who are just basically waiting on science. And I'm not refusing a vaccine. I'm declining something that isn't scientifically proven yet.
Yeah, and that's an important point because, you know, I'm sure as you know, you're characterized online as like you're an anti-vaxxer. And from what you've said,
not at all.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, but that's – and so, you know, and frankly that kind of smear job on somebody who just offered that a reasonable position that you offered, it creates more cynicism. That's what creates cynicism is when, you know, Dr. Cole, you just shut up and you just go along. You're not allowed to ask questions. You're not allowed to raise scientific concerns. And if you do so, we're just going to label you an anti-vaxxer so we can dismiss you.
Correct. And there's a lot of nuance in most of these arguments. And that's the thing I've invited my colleagues who disagree. I've certainly gotten plenty of vitriol and some really nasty, unsolicited letters and emails. That's fine. You know, water off a duck's back, I can take it. But at the same time, it's like if you really have an argument, share with me your contrary data or contrary position in a professional way. Let's discuss it on behalf of the patient. At the end of the day, we should all be in this to save a patient's life and improve what's happening worldwide.
So do you think just people in higher risk groups should be getting vaccinated, or do you think that that should be a personal choice between them and their doctor?
Obviously, I can't give anyone medical advice, but I do believe that that high-risk group is who we really created this for. Mm-hmm. And those individuals know who they are. Statistically, across a population, obviously, we have engendered a fair amount of fear in the society, and people think, you know, their chance of dying is pretty high. But really, if you look at under age 65 worldwide, that average for the risk rate, death rate, et cetera, really is equal to a flu year. And so those high-risk individuals, those elderly, absolutely, you know, if it's a risk-benefit analysis. So it's a personal calculation one needs to make. But again, I approach life not with this excessive fear, but this optimism, especially now that we've looked at a lot of the world data on early outpatient treatments around the world that we see working phenomenally. So, you know, I know there's some controversial medicines. A lot of people don't even let you name the name, but I've treated 54 patients, and I don't treat very often. I used to work emergency room family medicine, so I used to do a lot of clinical medicine. But it started with saving my younger brother's life, type 1 obese diabetic, COVID positive, on his way to the emergency room. And I prescribed ivermectin to him. He went from 9 out of 10 chest pain to 2 out of 10 within 6 hours. Wow. And his oxygen went from 86 to 98 in 24 hours. Wow. And that's one of those individuals that, you know, would consider a vaccine high risk, very, you know, high potential for hospitalization, intubation, and potentially death.
And what was the therapeutic you used again?
Ivermectin.
Ivermectin, yeah. I mean, it was originally developed as an anti-parasitic drug back in the 1980s. It won the Nobel Prize a few years ago because it saved so many people from so many parasitic diseases. But for over a decade or two, we've been discovering that it has antiviral properties against yellow fever and dengue and a bunch of other flavivirus family viruses. And so we've known it had certain properties. And so, you know, Australia did a study that showed it killed coronavirus 99.99% SARS-CoV-2 in petri dishes. And the criticism was, well, the dose would have to be too high. But other studies showed, you know, the way it concentrates in certain tissues in the body, the dose could be much lower and very tolerable. And it's the same one we use in nursing homes when there's like the skin mite outbreak, scabies. And in France, early in the outbreak a year ago, they had a skin mite outbreak, and that whole nursing home got ivermectin. And interestingly, as all the nursing homes around them were having high COVID rates, that nursing home had no outbreak. And so a lot of people scratched their head and said, wait a minute, this is seemingly preventing virus in this nursing home. A lot of studies have happened around the world, about 16,000 patients in 50 studies. And even in the worst, you add up those studies and do a meta-analysis, a statistical look, and it's decreased the death rate, depending on how you do the numbers, anywhere from 68 to 86%, depending on how early you give it. And so a lot of the world is using this. And again, it saved my younger brother's life. And I've treated 54 patients. 51 have been better in 12 to 48 hours. None of them have had to go to the hospital. Majority of those were very high-risk patients.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you raised the point. Before the vaccines, obviously, we spent a lot of time talking about therapeutics, which therapeutics were proving effective. There was obviously clinical trials associated with applying therapeutics that had been used to treat one ailment, like you're describing with ivermectin, to now treat COVID. Remdesivir comes online and so forth. And now that's all by the boards. And that's not how we deal with a flu, for example. Maybe this is the question of a layman, a simpleton, but we don't deal with the flu this way. We don't ostracize people who don't get the flu shot, and we say, well, there's nothing we can do unless you get the flu shot. Now we say, well, there's these over the counter therapeutics. There's other right. therapeutics. If you have a severe case of the flu, you know, why can't we have that same conversation about COVID?
We absolutely should be having that conversation. I agree with you. And that's the sad part, is we've really turned this into an us versus them argument instead of, look, if this is a pandemic and we're concerned about saving lives, let's be as creative as possible with all the known modalities we have to intervene honestly and early on the patient's behalf. And, you know, to your point, I mean, there Tamiflu, which is an oral form of remdesivir. In the flu, you really have to give that in the first 24 to 48 hours of symptoms to be effective when the virus is replicating. And it's interesting with this virus. I talked to an unfortunate gentleman last night, about 2 years younger than my mom. He's 76. I treated my mom for COVID, 78 years old, again, better in 2 days. This poor gentleman told me his story that, look, I went to the ER 2 weeks ago, COVID positive. They said, well, you know, you're not bad enough that we can intubate you, but or give you high flow oxygen, just go home. Well, he got worse. He over 2 weeks, he went to the hospital, to the emergency room 4 times. He got 1 or 2 breathing treatments, and he kept getting worse. And they said, well, go home. There's nothing we can do for you. And he called me last night, you know, explaining to me his symptoms and whatnot. But I just thought to myself, why did nobody intervene early on his behalf, when we know there are things that are very effective antivirally? And that's the nuance that, you know, I would like to discuss with colleagues. There are things we can be doing. Why are we telling people that there aren't? And why are we, certain individuals in medicine, getting criticized when we have solid statistical data? And, again, 54 patients that ended up not in the hospital, I mean, that's a pretty good success rate for one small doctor doing his part.
Well, doctor, I wanted to ask you about the vaccines. And if you're vaccinated and 14 days out or 10 days out, can you spread the virus to somebody else?
That's the unfortunate aspect. You know, Dr. Fauci was just a week and a half ago says, hey, we need to do the studies now to see that the vaccines are preventing transmission. And I scratched my head and I thought, why in the world would you not be doing the study a year ago when you were developing these things? And so that's the frustrating thing. These vaccines are what we call leaky vaccines, in the sense that they prevent symptoms and decrease hospitalization and severity. That's great. But we don't have the statistical data. In theory, a vaccine should prevent you from having the disease, create a sterilizing, neutralizing immunity, meaning you have the virus, you shouldn't be able to spread the virus. And I would suppose, based on the history of vaccinology, that's eventually what we're going to find in the majority of people. But it's ironic, we're giving these shots at the end of a winter season when vitamin D levels in the population are absolutely the lowest. And if you have a low vitamin D level, it's very hard for your immune system to make those strong antibodies. So it's an interesting question that scientifically we don't have the answer to, which is, again, medically frustrating.
Sticking on the vaccines, you know, I want to apply the same level of skepticism I have to the abundance of caution crowd on the pause in the J&J vaccine that I applied with all of their lockdown and other strictures with respect to COVID, over-extrapolating from the anecdotal, as they're wont to do, organizing our life around the worst case scenario rather than how we actually live, the most likely scenario. And so pausing the distribution of that vaccine because the FDA believes its credibility is somehow on the line because 6 women got blood clots after 6.8 million doses have been administered, that seems to me consistent with the overabundance of caution, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, and then obviously those injuries in those individuals are very, you know, very sad and very unfortunate. And we've known with adenovirus vector treatments, which J&J, you know, they put their DNA sequence into an adenovirus. We've known the history of gene therapy and the history of other vaccine tests that this is a probability in any of these. But I agree. I think the lockdowns were an extreme example following a communist nation's modality of control instead of a logical common sense. I mean, 3 weeks into this pandemic, a year ago, we knew the risk profile of those that this was affecting. We knew how we could sequester those individuals. And never in the history of humankind have we sequestered the well. And to your point, we extremely did something that was overly zealous and overly cautious. And your point is well taken. I agree.
And with respect to the vaccines, generally going back to sort of your opening statement on that, just to, for clarity purposes, the concern you have is not dismissing the reality on the ground. I mean, tens of millions of doses, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J. Yes, there have been some adverse outcomes. Many of them are reported on that VAERS site at CDC, of course, completely ignored by the press because they're just cheerleaders for wherever the left is going. But I digress. But you're saying, you know, what we don't know, sort of the medium long-term effects, and we're not going to know those until we get to the medium term or long term, or until there's more study of these viruses and their of these vaccines and their impacts. But I mean, you're not denying that, at least at first blush, based on the real world experience, they seem overwhelmingly safe as advertised.
At the moment, they're okay, but one has to consider, like with the VAERS data, Harvard did a study in 2010 that showed that only 1% of adverse reactions are reported to the government. And it's a pretty cumbersome form for clinicians to fill out if they see an adverse reaction. So I know a lot of clinicians don't. And if you look historically, and project that forward onto what we're seeing now, so over 60,000 adverse events, about 7,000 requiring hospitalization, 4,000 of which are about appear to be permanent, almost 3,000 deaths just in the United States, at about 4,000 or 5,000 in Europe, about 1,000 in the UK. I mean, from the shots alone, under investigation, are as many deaths as almost 3 9/11s at this point. So that's nothing to scoff at either. So when you look statistically, and in Europe they have almost 250,000 adverse events. So yeah, abundance of caution with these, because yes, there are immediate adverse events. Yes, there are deaths. It is a risk benefit against what we're seeing societally. So it's a tough calculation, but at the same time, we're already seeing those autoimmune reactions. We're already seeing some of those potential long-term adverse events appear in the near short term. It's very similar to our rush to flu vaccine and swine flu back in the 70s, where 46 million people quickly got vaccinated. And then in about 6 months to a year later, we were starting to see the neurologic side effects in autoimmune diseases. And so, again, I'm not giving anybody personal advice, but an abundance of caution with something like this, as well as we took that abundance of caution with an unnecessary lockdown, you just have to at least step back, be analytical, and say, okay, risk-benefit, and make that calculation personally.
Dr. Ryan Cole, he's a pathologist. He owns and operates Cole Diagnostics, a testing lab in Garden City, Idaho. Dr. Cole, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
You can win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Brian Deese is the director of the National Economic Council. That is the entity that coordinates economic policy across the executive branch. He was an Obama administration flunky, or Joe Bama, you know, term one and two flunky. And went off, made a bunch of money at BlackRock, and now he's back to be the director of the National Economic Council.
Why wouldn't he be, huh?
Right, Joe Bama, term three. He recently sat down with Vox's Ezra Klein on his podcast, and I think this is really telling, this question and answer exchange between the two of them, to tell you exactly what this infrastructure, you know, reimagined plan really is. I know infrastructure grows with America's aspirations. I understand. But that's not what this is. Remember when AOC's chief of staff was sort of ridiculed and it was like a gotcha moment when he said, you know, basically the Green New Deal isn't about isn't about anything with respect to tax increases. It's not about tinkering. This is about transforming the economy. He admitted this is their goal is transforming America, remaking America in their image. The question that Ezra Klein put to Brian Deese. In 2009, the stimulus got sold as timely, temporary, and targeted. There was this idea that what we were trying to do was accelerate recovery back to pre-crisis economic trends, and what's happening now in the Biden administration seems to be more fundamentally an argument that the pre-crisis economy was a disaster for both the people and the planet. Is that right? Deese, I think that's a pretty fair reflection. I think you put your finger on two of the important things, one of which is the growing income inequality that persisted over the course of a couple of decades but was laid bare during the pandemic. The other is climate change. We've also seen that impact accelerating. And in our view, having an economic strategy that is unresponsive or agnostic to those issues is no longer a viable option. So this is not a, you know, extending COVID relief in addition to the $2 trillion worth of funny money that was recently approved. This isn't about getting us back to the thriving pre-COVID economy. This is about transformation of America's economy as the central planners envision it. It's unequivocal. And I think Republicans haven't done a particularly good job of explaining to the American people that they're buying into the smokescreen that Democrats are running with. Hey, our door's open, you know, willing to negotiate with Republicans. And then Roger Wicker from Mississippi dutifully puts the hook in his mouth and says, yeah, you know, I'm open to negotiation too. Yeah, let's negotiate, rather than explaining to the public what this gambit truly is and the associated implications were they to get anything approximating what they've offered. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, and Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. Good morning.
Morning. So that Brian Deese, Ezra Klein exchange, pretty straightforward what they intend to do and what the implications would be.
Exactly. I mean, look, this is a transformation of the American economy and the common denominator here of all these programs is a much, much bigger government intrusion into our lives in every single area. It is a return. You know, it's so funny because Trump basically ran on draining the swamp, right? And basically Obama Biden people want to do is replenish the swamp. And Washington is going to get much more powerful, much richer, and the rest of the country it will get poorer. As a result of this massive expansion, it is a challenge to the whole idea of American exceptionalism. You know that America needs to be transformed. This obsession with climate change has become like a religion to the left. It's not based on science. It's based on this kind of religious fervor that we have to pay some kind of penance for our environmental crimes of the past. And it's very. I mean, look, I have never been more afraid for our country in the 61 years I've been on this planet than I am right now. And by the way, when the United States moves toward more government, which is basically more tyranny, guess what? The rest of the world follows our lead. I was in Florida this past week, and we had Dennis Quaid as our guest at the Committee on Unleashed Prosperity. And I don't know if you guys know this, but Dennis Quaid, you're probably wondering why I'm bringing this up, but there's a point here. Dennis Quaid is playing Ronald Reagan in this new major motion picture that will be out in February. Mm-hmm. And so he showed clips of the movie. I can't wait to see this movie because it really was a reappreciation of Reagan's, morning in America idea that it wasn't going to be government. You know, it was Reagan who said government is the problem. Government is not the solution. It's the problem. And now we've got that turned upside down. I'm very, very nervous about it.
So is Dennis Quaid a nice man? What did you take away from your talk with Dennis Quaid?
And he looks like Reagan. He he actually acts like Reagan. He looks like Reagan. You know, it was funny. People came up to him after and said, "I loved you in Parent Trap." You know? But he was really very personable. And there were, you know, scenes in there where, you know, Reagan stood toe to toe with Gorbachev and didn't back down to the Soviet Union. We won the Cold War. We rebuilt the economy because we believed in the free enterprise system. And I worry that we're moving away from that, Dan. I mean, we're moving away from we think the government is going to be the source of all our solutions. And no, government is the problem.
I know, but
I can't let a Dennis Quaid reference go without weighing in on this. Now, I assume that he apologized for his role in The Day After Tomorrow, which was one of those climate apocalyptic movies.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, make him apologize for that.
I forgot about that. You know,
That was
the climate change apocalypse movie, right?
That's right. It was also a terrible movie on top
Horrible.
Of it. But
but yet we watched it.
But he made up for it in two movies. One, we're both relatively recent, actually, Dog's Journey.
Oh, that was really good. Yeah.
Yeah. And very underrated. This was excellent.
What?
I've recommended it before. Born a Champion with it's a MMA movie. That was, I think, made independently. Quaid, yeah, it was Sean Patrick Flannery, but Dennis Quaid's in it. He does a good job. So, you know, you gotta be constructively critical, but then also complimentary.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There you go again.
Yeah. There. So, you know, when you're in town May 20th for that Breakthrough Ideas event that we're doing in the Western Burbs, Jeannie Ives's group. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more. We'll get into the real weeds on Dennis Quaid's filmography. How does that sound?
Yeah, we'll try to get him to come to that. Look, I mean, Jeannie Ives is doing a great job of really grassroots organizing. We need that around the country against what's going on. I hear that you're going to be the MC of that event, so I'm proud to be part of it.
Yeah, expect a lot of zingers.
By the way, I will not go to Wrigley Field, and I will not go to Wrigley Field, even though I practically grew up in Wrigley Field, because I am so infuriated by Major League Baseball and what they've done in Atlanta. If they don't move that game back to Atlanta, these woke, Major League owners, I'm through with these people. I mean, I'm sick of the CEOs of America just caving into Black Lives Matter and these leftist groups. So I'm not
golf. Golf is all we have left.
I'm
Steve.
Not watching baseball.
The PGA is all we have left. Just to stick with me on golf.
Exactly. At least they stayed in Atlanta, and they stayed in Augusta, Georgia. And look, I mean, this is a serious point, though. Why are look? Does anybody think that the Major League Baseball commissioner knows anything about voting laws?
No, he didn't read that law.
Delaware has more restrictive laws on voting than Georgia does. I mean, maybe we should be boycotting Delaware.
Well, what did you think? I mean, 120 CEOs and media conglomerates all met via a Zoom conference on Saturday to talk about this and how they could fight back against restrictive laws like the Georgia law.
Well, first, again, this is a voter integrity law. The left pounced upon it, and they've kind of redefined this as, what's the term they use, voter suppression law. They keep it up calling it voter suppression law. This, as I want to say this again, folks, they are more open in their election process. It's easier to vote in Georgia than it is in Delaware. And Joe Biden is from Delaware. So this idea that somehow, you know, we're discriminating against people, no. As the Georgia State Attorney General said very well, we want to protect the vote. We want to make sure that people are not voting illegally. Because when people vote illegally, that is basically a way of taking away your vote if you're a legal citizen. So they want to get rid of voter ID. The Democrats want to get rid of voter ID. Everything I do, if I want to get on an airplane, if I want to drive my car, if I want to use my credit card, if I want to go to a movie, I have to show my ID. The only thing in America they don't want IDs for is voting. I don't even understand the logic of that.
I want to get back to this Green New Deal and Groucho Marx glasses. I was watching your buddy there, Larry Kudlow, on his Fox Business program over the weekend, and he had one of the economists he had on was Peter Morici from University of Maryland. And Morici's point, and he's not, you know, he's not a free market supply sider like you or I, but he's okay. And Larry seems to like him, so that's good enough for me. But his point, Morici's point, was that those same corporate titans that we're talking about that are so insufferable are going to put the arm on the Biden administration to ratchet down their grand plans as so embodied in this legislation they've proposed. Mm-hmm. And so it's not going to be, you're not going to see the increases in the corporate tax and some of the other more anti-growth measures, at least not as pronounced as proposed. And so it's unlikely to be as transformative as they so desire. I mean, do you share that sort of realism that Morici was offering?
You know, I'm nervous about it. I you know, if you'd asked me a couple months ago, are they going to pass a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill that is not necessary because we already have a trillion? I would say no, they're not going to pass that, but they are. If you asked me, are they going to try to get rid of the filibuster? I said no, that's been with us for 60 years. They're not, but they are. If you asked me if they're going to try to make Washington D.C. and Puerto Rico states, I would said no, but they are. If you asked me, are they going to try to expand the Supreme Court? I would said no, but they are trying to do those things. And look, they are drunk with power right now because they have towering majorities. You know, they have one-seat majority in the Senate and, what, four-seat majority in the House or something like that. And, no, these people are like the German soldiers, you know, going over the border into Poland. They're an unstoppable force right now. And, God, it's a sad country when with Joe Manchin is what's protecting our liberty. You know, the guy has no spine. And no, I'm very nervous. These guys are deadly serious. They do. You put it very well, Dan. They want to transform America, and they see this as their magic moment. And where, by the way, are the Democrats? Where are my Democratic friends saying, "Hey, stop! This is damaging America. This is not what we voted for. This was supposed to be lunch bucket Joe." Remember, he said, "I'm not going to be Bernie Sanders. I'm going to be running this party." Well, guess what? So far, his agenda has been to the left of Bernie Sanders. Right?
He is Steve Moore, Trumponomics author, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Civilian Office of Police Accountability, COPA, in Chicago. At the request of the Toledo family today, COPA will not immediately release video and other materials as the family continues to grieve their loss. COPA has advised family representatives that while it is acutely sensitive to the family's grief and their desire to avoid the public release of materials related to Adam's tragic death, COPA is mandated to comply with the city's video release policy, and COPA said it will do so within the 60-day mandatory period they have to produce the video for public consumption after the family now has viewed it. Is that the right play to show some sensitivity and delay, artificially delay the release of that body cam footage? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, they went to see it last night. They didn't speak to reporters. The family went. The mom was there, some other family members, the attorney. They didn't speak on the way in. They were there for about 2 hours. On the way out, they didn't answer any questions. And what surprised a lot of people is, we thought that once they watched the video, they would say, okay, it's okay to release it. But they're not there yet. I don't know if they're still processing it or if they didn't like what they see, or maybe he looks culpable or responsible in the video. But when in our lifetime has Lightfoot and COPA publicly put the decision on whether or not to release a video on the grieving family?
It's not whether or not to release. It's the timing.
The timing. And I know a lot of community activists are, you know, up in arms. They're up all night and this morning on, you know, local news saying, we need to see this video right now. Do we need to see the video right now?
Like this Baltazar Enriquez, president of Little Village Community Council. We've been demanding this video for over 2 weeks. Well, okay. Well, Mr. Enriquez, so who is it you want us to defer to? The family or you?
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
It seems to me that they're ready to release it now, and the family, and they're deferring to the family. So these community activists, is your target the police or COPA for that matter, or is it the family?
Well, they're just fixing for a fight. Come on. That's why the businesses are boarded up, some businesses along Michigan Avenue. That's why we have another green zone around the Mag Mile. Because it's not if, it's when. They're gonna loot and take things that aren't theirs again.
Do they not want to release it because it would be subordinated to all of the Dante Wright coverage? Oh. Is that a possibility? They want their
time,
their attention. I mean, I'm not questioning the family's motives to say that they're that sort of like attention. I'm not saying attention seeking necessarily, for the purposes of demagoguing the issue. But I'm just saying that they want the public to be focused on the killing of their son versus anybody else. And obviously, all eyes are on Brooklyn Center and Minneapolis right now.
Right, because of George Floyd and because of obviously Dante Wright.
So you can take that in a innocently constructed, which is how I offered it, but you can also take it as the prospect of as raising the question of whether cynicism should attach here too. Right? I mean, look, the description of what the video will show as offered by prosecutors in court, it doesn't sound very good for Adam Toledo and his family. And you also have the 21-year-old guy who was shooting at passing cars in custody who said that Toledo was with him while he was shooting at passing cars. At least this is according to prosecutors again. So, I don't know what the play here is. And maybe the play here is it doesn't matter because it's going to be so terrible to see a 13-year-old boy shot to death, and that is a terrible thing.
It is terrible, but
that it doesn't matter the circumstances, that people won't care that he was in the wrong, that the officer was in the right. Again, this is assuming the video bears out what prosecutors describe. And so it won't matter, and this will be our opportunity to get justice for Adam Toledo, because this is the phrase that's being thrown around by those community activists as well as families' legal representatives, justice for Adam Toledo. What if the justice for Adam Toledo is that he put himself in a position where the officer was compelled to use lethal force? Will it matter?
Will it matter if the officer's white or black or Latino, and it was a Latino on Latino thing? Who knows?
Well, sure, right. The race of the officer will be used or not used depending on what it is. And if the officer is a Latino or a black officer, then it'll just be about the white supremacy that consumes all police departments in America. Doesn't matter. It's about blue. It's not about black, white, or Latino.
We got a text message in. It's Amy and Dan. This is so the attorneys can get their story straight. That's why they're not releasing it. They want to process it and then come out with a solid script.
Yeah, that's perhaps on advice of counsel. They'd like it delayed. And of course, COPA is going to be want, and the city will be want to be deferential to the family because they don't want to get, on the wrong side of the family. It's much easier for them to say, hey, we're standing with the family. You got a problem, then talk to the family. That's a much easier political play. Sure, that makes sense.
But some people feel like they're, coddling this kid. Yeah, he was a young 13-year-old, but who had just, got a tattoo of the Latin Kings on his arm. He joined a gang. And they feel like they're giving them more respect than they are the police.
Well, do we know he was a member of a gang?
Oh, yeah. I talked to an official in the Chicago Police Department who said he recently got a tattoo on his arm. And he was not a stranger to police.
Okay. Well, yeah, a tattoo on the arm is one thing.
Oh, well, Latin Kings.
A Latin Kings tattoo on the arm is still one thing. I want more confirmation than that before we start assuming facts, not in evidence. But
well, the 21-year-old too that he was with is a member too.
Fine. Let's just walk before we run in terms of what we know, and address these issues as they come up. And the issue now is the release of this video. This is why the body cams and dash cams were mandated in the first place. And I understand the concerns on the other side that the result is that all these cases get adjudicated in the court of public opinion well before they ever make it to a court of law, and it inflames passions and it poisons jury pools and so on and so forth. Right. But that's where we're at. We're at where these things are mandated. So if they're mandated, then you can't play games with them.
And shame again, on the media, though, too.
COPPA is saying they're going to comply with the 60-day window. So, the only controversy is a judgment call that they're making about deferring to the family.
And what I was going to say is the media is using this. It looks like a baby picture of him, where we have the picture that they're using on TV is not representative of his age right now.
Mm-hmm. Mike in Rutherford, Texas.
Hey, listen, first off, if that kid had an LK tattoo in LK neighborhood, and he wasn't LK, they would have cut it or burned it off. Okay, so there you go. There's your evidence, Dan.
I understand that. I understand you don't just go walking around with that without consequence. But, kids are stupid. They do stupid things. I just don't want to assume facts
right.
We don't know.
Right. Second, when was the last time the nitwits at Randy City did anything for the right reason?
I can't remember.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And third off, it doesn't make any difference when they release this video. The outcome is going to be the same. The politics and the rabid barbarian crowd is what matters. We've abandoned the rule of law, reason, and logic, and we've descended into barbarism. It's not going to matter. They don't care. They're going to see what they want to see in that video, regardless of the facts.
Thanks for the call, Mike. That's a legitimate concern, that people will see what they want to see, with regardless of the facts.
Because he was turning and dropping the gun at the same time he got shot in the side. So there you go. You're either shot in the front, you're shot in the back, but he shot on the side.
We don't know he was turning and dropping the gun.
I talked to somebody who watched the video, and that's what they told me.
You're somebody's. What has been reported is in the prosecutor.
Right.
So somebody who's actually in charge of the case in a court of law was that he was turning. He had a gun in his hand and in his left hand, and he turned right into the officer. And when the officer saw the gun in his hand and him turning toward the officer, that's when he fired. Right.
Yeah. It's the same story. After a foot
here.
Chase that ended in an alley by a fence in an alley. And the whole time they're saying, drop your weapon, drop your weapon.
Of course, Chicago, there was some, it's so funny. Four people can show up to protest, and it's a big deal. Above the fold story. So
we got to lead with it.
There were Chicago protesters out yesterday, protesters in Chicago in response to the Dante Wright shooting in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. And something else that has greater applicability than just Brooklyn Center, it's part of this raging debate over policing in America, was raised by the mayor of Brooklyn Center, Mike Elliott. And I want to make sure people hear this. In addition to dismissing both the police chief as well as his city manager, because they raised the specter of due process for the officer involved in the shooting, Officer Kimberly Potter. Due process now is fighting words? Okay. In addition to taking that position, Mayor Elliott of Brooklyn Center had this to say about police and traffic stops.
I don't believe that officers need to necessarily have weapons every time they're making a traffic stop or engaged in situations that don't necessarily call for weapons. We know that there are many other jurisdictions or even around the world where that is not necessarily the case. It's not needed.
What do you think about that? What about uniformed Chicago police officers who do traffic detail and are unarmed? What do you think about the prospects of that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro, text line, or turn traffic stops over to non-law enforcement. Make it administrative in nature, you know, security guard types. Now, again, in the Dante Wright case, since this is the context in which he's raising it, you've got a bit of a wrinkle, and that bit of a wrinkle is that this wasn't just about a traffic stop that went awry. This was about a traffic stop that identified a person who had an outstanding warrant for a gun charge. Now, do you still want police to be disarmed, or do you want some administrative agent rather than a police officer to make that stop to try to bring that person into custody? Or does you have an administrative agency that does the pullover based on the expired plate, and they would be writing the citation. They run the plate. They realize that this person has an arrest warrant out for a gun charge, and then they call armed police. It's a two-step. How do you want to do it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Tim in West Chicago.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, just wanted to say I find it telling that through all this, where has Kim Fox been?
Who?
It's telling to me that, hello?
Yeah, no, I was being facetious. Go on.
Oh, yeah, where has she been? I mean, it sounds like the prosecutors are saying they've seen the video, and it sounds like they're saying there's, you know, fault on the part of the teenager. She's not saying anything, which kind of leads me to believe that, yeah, this kid was at fault.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Byron in the Western Burbs.
Hey, hi, good morning. There's I view this as two different levels. One at a low level is the boy was being mentored by the 21-year-old in the Latin Kings, and in the communities with gangs, you're either with a gang or you're against the gang. You can't be an independent. And you can't rely on the police to protect your back, so you have to join a gang, and that's what I think that boy did. At a much higher level, though, problem with children like that joining gangs and being led into them and all, I just see it going up the Lightfoot. She's not doing anything economically for these communities. She's not trying to help get jobs for anybody. It just continues to languish. And so those gangs have to continue the way they are, and unfortunately that boy is caught in that. Regardless if he's at fault, there's still a tragedy that way.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Byron. Okay. Betsy on the north side.
Yeah, I have been listening to you for quite a while, and I think, you know, you're really worthy of national and international listening. I really mean it sincerely.
Yeah, you know, he's a man of international mystery. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Betsy. You're a majority of one, but thank you.
No, that's the truth. I listen to a lot. But, you know, what strikes me, Amy and Dan, is that, you know, we are fighting, it seems, a cultural war where good is bad and bad is good. And we have no, you know, and I said this before, I've always been very progressive and liberal, but I'm certainly not part of this blind mindset. I mean, my family came here from a communist country. I know what it's like. You know, I love America, but we have lost our way. That's the bottom line, that we give all the attention to people who are doing wrong. Where is the responsibility from families, from communities? They've been frightened too and pushed into this mindset of, you know, rebellion against what? You know, what are they rebelling against? Goodness? You know, true equality, true equity? I just don't get it. And I think we have, I hope the next generation, usually, you know, they rebel against their elders. I hope the next generation turns out to be a bunch of Chuck Percys. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Thanks for the call, Betsy. Boy, I wasn't expecting a Chuck Percy reference this morning. So it's an interesting point she raises. We raised this, I think, Monday, first talking about this. The police officer who shot and killed Adam Toledo, do you think he or she was looking to gun down a 13-year-old?
No.
Do you think it's traumatic? Do you think to take the life of a 13-year-old, no matter what the circumstance? Do you think that that police officer is thinking about that? Does a police officer have humanity? Are they human beings, police officers? And there's no consideration. There's sort of this, you know, everything is deference to the identitarians. And I understand to an extent the deference to the family. I do. But the police officer is just sort of seen as this sort of faceless, non-human organ of the state. I suspect that's probably not the case. I mean, it's definitely not the case, generally speaking. Based on what we know at this point, I suspect that it's probably not the case here. It's a terrible thing when you know as a police officer, based on what has happened to Chicago and so many urban centers, that you could be in a position where you have to shoot a teenager. Because those are the people, those are some of the people that are committing some of these violent crimes. And if you're going to protect the law abiding, then you have to stop predators, you know, almost regardless of their age. Certainly,
well, yeah.
Certainly once you're in your teens and if you're a member of a gang and you're engaged in violent activity, then you have put yourself in a terrible position, a very dangerous position, as we know.
And it was dark out. And Lord knows if he knew if he was a teenager.
Well,
but there were shots fired, and he's hanging with a 21-year-old.
He knows now.
He knows, right.
Let's just say it's a he. Yeah. He knows now. And so, again, does a police officer have humanity? How about a black police officer? How about a Latino officer? Because I know white men, particularly if they're conservative and police officers, they don't have humanity. I got that. How about a black police officer, a Latino police officer, a female police officer? Do they have humanity? Are they human beings? Is there consideration there? Jerry in Hammond.
Hey, good morning. How you guys doing today?
Morning.
Good.
Listen, I kind of maybe have a radical idea. I got a couple of ideas. I'm a little bit different. I say, as far as police go, I say stop pulling people over for victimless crimes. You know, I mean, I'm pulling a kid over because he's got air fresheners hanging on his
rearview mirror. That's not why he was pulled over.
Yeah, that's not why he was pulled, right.
That's what his mom said, but it's not the reason why.
He had expired tags.
Okay, well, even expired tags for that matter. I mean, as a victimless crime, no one was hurt. You know, even speed. I mean, I know it sounds kind of radical. Or you know, normally talk about being pulled over because they said I rolled through a stop sign. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous, you know. Just and really, it all comes from the war on drugs. I mean, they start with these little petty crimes, and they start to investigate, and they start poking, then you get them out the car, you know? And I saw the video from the kid in theory. He definitely pointed the gun at the cop. He definitely did that. I'm surprised they didn't shoot him sooner. So,
thanks for the call, Jerry. I mean, I will say this about stops. You know, turning police, there is a problem of making police revenue agents. You know, and we've talked about this before with ticket quotas and those sorts of things. That's an inappropriate use of police as far as I'm concerned. So if you want to talk about reducing the police role as revenue agents for the municipality, then I'm all ears on that. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, it seems that the bad guys who carry guns and all that is just fine and dandy. You know, nobody did anything wrong. Why are you hurting my son or whatever? You know, notwithstanding the fact that they've got criminal records, are in gangs, so on and so forth. But you two, me, and many of your other listeners who got FOID cards or concealed carries, we're the bad guys, and we shouldn't have guns, and God forbid you have this or have that. You know, it's just insane. I don't know where the reality is anymore. You guys
Thanks.
Have a good one.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, and the NCAA has weighed in with the woke in the week. Today, the NCAA confirming it, this was the other day, confirming it will pull events from states with bills banning trans students from participating in school sports, you know, on their terms.
Guess we're not going to South Dakota.
The ACLU trumpeting the NCAA's decision, saying state lawmakers take note, discriminating against trans youth is wrong, against the law, and costly. Notre Dame professor Patrick Deneen responded to that. Once the left was fierce in its defense of the people against the powerful moneyed interests, now they're on the same page. Conservatives must now fight against the oligarchy on behalf of ordinary citizens who know that biological men competing against women is wrong. Yes, well, I agree with that.
It's also a safety hazard.
Will it come to pass? I mean, this is obviously targeting, there's 30-plus states that have legislation pending, if not moved, like Arkansas, Tennessee, that would ban essentially what we're talking about, men competing in women's sports. And so what is a state to do? Well, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster had this reaction to the NCAA.
No, it doesn't. I think the NCAA ought to mind their own business. If they want to pass laws, they need to run for office.
Why does everybody in South Carolina sound like Fritz Hollings? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Dave Seminara, a former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and the forthcoming book, Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me back on the show.
You're a bit frustrated with the corporate products, corporately produced products you can no longer use as well, out of a sense of not wanting to participate with this sort of anti-intellectual silliness.
Yes, products and also sports leagues, as you're pointing
yes,
out.
Right.
I'm a sports nut, too. I mean, my house is unfortunately full of products made by increasingly woke corporations, and I'm also a sports nut, and I'm upset because I would actually like to go to a Rays game. I live down here in Tampa Bay. I'd like to go to a Rays game, but I'm angry at Major League Baseball. Now I'm angry at the NCAA. I'm getting angry at everyone. I think, you know, we sort of need to take a step back here and find out what is going on. Why are companies doing this? I'm sorry, go ahead, Dan.
No, I was going to say, what do you suspect? What's the reason?
Well, here's what I suspect, a couple of different things going on. First of all, I think they see the example of companies like Nike and Twitter and others who have gone woke, you know, earlier than many of the others, and they haven't suffered anything for it. In fact, their business has increased. I mean, I remember thinking, you know, when Nike was lavishing money on Colin Kaepernick years ago and other companies, I thought, oh, they're going to pay for this. There's going to be hell to pay. You know, their stock price will go down. Their revenue will go. It hasn't. Same thing with Twitter. You know, they can go as woke as they want, and they still keep making more money, and their share price keeps going up. So first of all, companies have seen that there's really no price to pay for going woke. They make liberals very happy. I mean, I think liberals demand a lot more of the companies that they patronize than conservatives do. Liberals demand that companies share their values, and they bogey and boycott them if they don't. Whereas conservatives, I think we make our consumer decisions largely based upon, you know, the quality of the product or the service. And we don't really pay too much attention to what's going on sort of behind the scenes. So I think that's part of the dynamic. I think the other part of it is you've got these millionaire CEOs who basically the circles that they travel in, they get a lot of social capital, a lot of cultural capital out of being liberal and woke. It makes them feel good about themselves. You know, if you make $10 million per year, and those are the sort of elite sort of circles you travel in. You want to be out at the cocktail party saying, oh, isn't this great? We're standing up for the transgender community, or we're doing this or that or the other thing. I think it makes them feel really good about themselves. So they see no downside to going woke, and I think they also they get something out of it in the circles they travel in. I don't know. Do you agree?
Yeah. You know, what's concerning, too, is that Saturday Zoom conference that they had with 120 different CEOs and people that own media, like newspapers and television, and that they're teaming up to attack states. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, and I would say too, one other dynamic that's happening too is I think a lot of these companies have made the calculation that conservatives and Republicans are like just basically older white people, and that's not the demographic they're going for. They want younger, like every company in the world is striving for that younger consumer because they want to build that brand loyalty from a younger age. So companies are thinking about their strategies in terms of wooing young, diverse consumers, not like old white guys who tend to be the Fox News demographic, right? So I think that they think they can just take us for granted and just shoot for that younger demographic, which tends to be more liberal, right? Is that part of it?
I think that's part of it. I mean, part of it is even the companies that aren't really, that's not really their market position. I think of big banks, you know, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. I mean, it's not, you know, a bunch of millennials that whose money they're managing. But it's the clientele. So much of the clientele, wealthy clientele, champagne socialists, they want to be hip and cool and, you know, in the now, like some of these CEOs do too. So it's sort of a bit of self-reinforcement, I think. And so that, so then what's the response, I guess, and where does the response come from? It seems to me that most of the big companies we're talking about, the big players we're talking about, are rent seekers. They have a lot of skin in the political game, in the policy game, by necessity in part and by opportunity in part. And so it was interesting. I looked up this study that was done by Zipia, which is a career advice website. They analyzed contributions from employees at the 250,000 biggest companies in America. Looked at 30 million donations over a 10-year period, 2007 to 2017. And this, I think, this trend I'm about to tell you is probably only increased over the last 3 or 4 years. Then they just the report, they took the 30 most politically active companies on the Fortune 500, ranked them in order of their campaign contributions, and then distributed, you know, Republican versus Democrat. Of the top 30 most politically active, in terms of money given via employees, Fortune 500 companies, 20 of them give more money to Democrats than Republicans. So The Republican Party, it seems to me, has a market opportunity. And that is to say, you know, in the grand scheme of things, even those top 30, the amount of money they give doesn't really amount to much in terms of the cost of campaigns these days, in addition to the ability to raise a lot of money through small dollar donations online, as we've seen in the, you know, the recent half a dozen campaign cycles. Tell corporate America to go pound it. We don't want your money. We're not taking any money. We're not soliciting your money. We'll return any money that we're given. I mean, obviously, if there's, you know, there's a Bernie Marcus at Home Depot that wants to, you know, align and is down with the fight, and it's an entrepreneur who struck it, fine, okay. That, I mean, there are exceptions, making sort of a general statement. But make it clear to the public that the left is the party of big business. Big business is a party of the left. We want nothing to do with it. We are going to stake our claim. We're going to make our permanent residence, not our summer residence, on Main Street, and we're going to go up against K Street and Wall Street. I just think presenting a moral clarity and a simple binary to the public, maybe that's a way to provide that sort of cost to these woke corporations that's going to be very hard to provide, you know, one conservative op-ed at a time.
It could be. I mean, it could be. I just don't know. Can we count on the Republican Party to have some backbone here? Because this is a watershed moment. These Georgia boycotts, I mean, it's so unfair. I mean, calling this law repeatedly and brainwashing people into thinking there's something racist about this law. I mean, you know, this article that I wrote for the Wall Street Journal, you know, a week or two ago about the woke corporations, I cannot tell you, I've never received more feedback on something I've written in my entire life. 80% of it was, you know, people saying, right on, I totally agree with you. And do you have a list of companies we should boycott? But then maybe 15 or 20% are people just sending me nasty hate mail saying, how could you support this racist law, and so on and so forth. People are completely brainwashed. And the question now is, you know, I should say some people on the left are brainwashed. But the question is now is, does the Republican Party have the backbone to stand up to these corporations, or are they going to capitulate? I mean, let's face it, this is a party that has, you know, really been trying to kowtow to corporate interests for a very long time. And now the question is, you know, are we going to be the party of, you know, the interests of middle class America and working class America? or are they going to basically give in? I don't know what's going to happen. And what do you think?
Well, I don't know either. I just say there's an opportunity there. I mean, right. Do Republicans have the stomach for this? I have no idea. I'm actually rather pessimistic that most of them do. But I actually think some of the leading lights of the party at present do. And that starts with Ron DeSantis in Florida.
Right.
And it's been evidenced by what he's actually done. It's not just, you know, speechifying, which is what you get from Senate Republicans. It's
right.
You know, he issued an executive order banning critical race theory from in indoctrination in K-12 schools in Florida. I mean, that's the sort of thing that just should be happening everywhere, but it's only happening with Ron DeSantis in Florida. Maybe Greg Abbott would do some of that stuff. I don't know. Kristi Noem, she's obviously a bit wishy-washy on the NCAA. So, you know, but I think then it becomes a question, and this is perhaps the way you have to sell it. You have to appeal to their electoral interests. If you don't do that, you won't have a party. You're not, because you, who will you represent if you're not willing to go to the mat for middle income families that, you know, form the Trump coalition? Then you don't have a constituency. You don't have a party. At least you'll never have a governing party. So then you can either, you know, take the window or the stairs here.
I know. I just think about things, you know, I cannot control what the Republican Party does. There aren't enough Ron DeSantis's out there. Josh Hawley, I think, is another good one who shows some promise. There's not enough of those guys out there. I can only think about what can I do as a person, as a consumer, and I'm trying to make much more careful decisions with my spending power and, you know, the products that I buy. And I'm looking at these companies' websites, and I'm looking at their Twitter feeds, and I'm looking at these letters that these CEOs are signing, and I'm paying very close attention to which ones I have in my investment portfolio, too. Like PayPal is another one. You know, PayPal, I own PayPal stock, and you know, they're part of this Georgia boycott crowd, along with Delta and Coca-Cola and all these other companies. And guess what? I do not want to patronize these companies anymore. And unless they feel it from us, the consumers, I just don't think it's ever going to change. They need to actually see their share price going down. They need to see their sales going down. They can't just keep taking half of their customer base for granted anymore.
He is Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and the forthcoming book, Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, guys. Take care.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.